Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by Matt Stratton, who is the founder of Coalition Limited. Matt and I talk about his first venture into the combination product space years and years ago. Matt talks about how working with one of Intel's most iconic CEOs helped shape his approach to product development. Matt also talks about collaboration challenges in the combination product space, specifically difficulties in speed to market. He talks about the role of turnover and the difficulty that brings into the long product development cycles in medtech and pharma, and how to potentially deal with those. If you're not already subscribed to the show on whatever platform you're listening on, please hit the subscribe button. And if you're not already part of the LinkedIn group, please follow the show there. With that, here is the episode with Matt.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery, so this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen. And together, we can simplify by combinating.
Yes. I just started it about 6 months ago. After 20-something years in the med tech and combination product space, working for other companies and helping them move more quickly, I decided that I would start my own venture up and try and teach a wider group of companies what I've been able to learn over the last years.
Now, your first introduction into combination products was with one of the CEOs of Intel, correct?
Yes. So I was working for an engineering company in the UK that had nothing to do with medical devices or combination products. They had a lot of expertise in precision positioning and measurement, but they'd been set up by two guys who were post-retirement. This is going back 20 years, and I say close to retirement because they were beyond retirement age, and neither of them have retired yet still, so they showed a dedication to their field. But they wanted to spread the risk of the business a little before they retired, and wanted therefore to get into different areas where their core technologies would be useful, and we had a lot of patents of ours that were being cited in the surgical robotics space, but they wanted to move to a different group of industries where the economic cycle was different. They invested a lot of money into R&D, 20% each year. They're in quite a rural part of the UK. So they had lots of engineers relocating into this nice part of the UK. And I think there was the rumor at one stage that the chairman's wife never wanted to bump into anybody in the local supermarket that her husband had made redundant, was one of the drivers behind it. But nevertheless, they decided they wanted to get into healthcare. And the first step that we took was to take a machine that they were already manufacturing, but to rescale it for purpose. So we found out we had a machine that was about the size of a pool table, and it was being used for the measurement and characterization of single tooth coping, which is the thing that sits underneath the porcelain if you have a new tooth inserted. So what they needed to do was the scale wasn't appropriate. They reduced it significantly, made it appropriate for size so that it fit the dental surgeries. Now that took them into the healthcare space, and we needed a 13485 certificate, but it was not a regulated product as such. So it was a small step in. Our next step was...
Why did you have to go through and get a cert if it wasn't regulated?
So the cert was required because there was also a manufacturing system attached to it. and the resultant copings may have been produced according to it. However, there was an uncertainty, and it was a conservative approach because we were using a named patient exemption in Europe as well. So reality, they probably didn't need it, but it was a helpful step for us to build on.
Sure. So, okay. And the named patient thing is?
I'm not even sure if this is still valid, but at the time, if you were creating single implants for named patients, you could circumvent the regulatory approval process. I believe that.
Oh, so this is like custom medical device.
Exactly right.
I see.
Okay. So in MDD, there was a different treatment to MDR.
Understood. Okay. On you go. Sorry for the interruption. Okay.
Not at all. But it was a first full step. A useful first step. The next step, though, was more of a jump in with both feet up to our waist, because we decided that there was a great opportunity for us in being able to help the placement of deep brain stimulation leads to become more accurate. So if you think about placing deep brain stimulation leads and the process that you'd have to go through, there's a huge number of problems there's lots of sources of error from the point that when you're trying to take images before surgery, you've got a patient lying down and you're imaging somebody for a long period of time. You want the patient to be as still as possible, so you sedate them, but they still need to breathe, which it gives you your first sort of error because the brain is moving as the patient is breathing. And then when you take them to the operating theater, you have them typically in a different orientation. And then when you open up the skull and open up the dura, which is the membrane that sits over the brain, you get a pressure drop. So you get the brain is a jelly floating in a fluid. You get some movement there. Then you start putting probes into it to get down to the target place. And by this stage, all of your pre-planned imaging was of less use when it comes to precision or precision placement. Lots of centers would then send down electrophysiological recording probes multiple times to look for signature firing patterns of the target that was being sought. Now that's fraught with accuracy issues as well. And it also meant you need to keep the patient awake throughout, which meant the surgery is very long and very harrowing, both for the patient and also the surgical teams. So we felt that going for a more image guided approach and looking at each of the steps in that process and either being able to minimize errors or to be able to record or understand what the errors were would be a good way of improving that workflow and ultimately getting more accuracy in the placement of these leads and therefore hopefully more consistency in the outcome of the surgeries. So that was our first port of call. And we decided to do that. We developed a series of products. We bought a surgical robotic company. We bought another company that would help us with RF imaging, or a transmission of the images. So with the MRI images, we then developed some systems to help hold the patient still, both in the operating theater and in the imaging suite, and transfer the coordinate systems more accurately. We developed other accessories and ultimately some implantable devices to replicate the deep brain stimulation lead so that you could verify the ultimate position relative to the target. You couldn't do that with deep brain stimulation leads at the time. You still couldn't now because you get eddy currents and distortions. Typically at the time, you would also get heating of the leads, which could cause all sorts of mischief for the patient. So it was an interesting challenge.
And so they were an industrial company, and it sounds like they went deep into med tech.
Exactly right. So they were an industrial company, and our first step was to do that. And then we used that same methodology for drug delivery. So working with biotech companies and cell and gene therapy companies. So we took it straight into the combination product space. Our first product that we licensed, got a CE mark, was a class 3 active implantable medical device. So really very far into the regulated world at the time, although the regulations have evolved significantly over the last 20 years. It was a much higher hurdle than the rest of the company had considered. So one of the things we did is we ground our development programs almost to a shuddering halt by bringing in regulatory teams and quality management systems and all of those sorts of things. And we were benchmarking and being benchmarked against the rest of the company, which was an industrial company and didn't have these complexities and these additional requirements. And we were therefore being forced to really think deeply and quickly about how we could speed back up to the pace that the rest of the industry, or sorry, the rest of the company was used to, which took us one step. And then we met the guy that you mentioned, Andy Grove. So Andy had a really unique position in this world. He was the employee number four at Intel. He's sometimes classed as a founder. And apparently, he just decided he was going to go and join Intel. And Gordon Moore of Moore's Law's fame didn't really have much of a choice in that. He forced himself in there. He was a very direct character. But he took over as CEO in 1996 when the company was turning over around about $1 billion a year, just a little more than $1 billion. And he stepped back as CEO in 98, so 13 years later, with the company turning over $26 billion a year. Now, we mentioned Moore's law is that there would be a doubling of processor power every 2 years. I think it was 2 years for a while. It was 18 months for a period of time as well. But that was his belief and his observation. And to keep pace with that, that meant that there needed to be significant product launches every couple of years. And these are product launches where you are doubling performance of the previous generation. And also you need to be able to manufacture these things at enormous scale. So Andy's perspective on what good speed in product development looked like was that you had a new technically complex product every couple of years. Now, the reason that we met him is his other reason why he had a unique position is that he was a patient. He developed Parkinson's disease, and he was very keen to find ways of being able to beat Parkinson's disease. So he was busy trying to invest his way out or support companies and academics who could really help him find a way forward. And he was, as you might expect, a very impatient patient. And therefore, as well as having benchmarked ourselves against an industrial organization that had been very successful, we were now having our feet held to the fire by the guy who'd shown the greatest level of advanced at the time in the world. So it was a high bar that we were being held against.
And sorry, his relation to the company was?
So he was seeking to find companies that could help him put together
a company.
Yeah.
So he became effectively a client.
He was looking to stitch us up, to connect us with biopharmaceutical and cell and gene therapy companies to be able to do some studies to develop a combination product system. And when I mean system, that also includes the whole robotics suite, so planning and all the other good things that were associated with it, to be able to allow treatment for him and a number of other patients, and ultimately to get products approved and on the market. So
that's a unique psychosocial situation to be in. What was his temperament like during that? Because those kinds of folks are what a lot of people aspire towards, and seeing someone vying for a cure, I guess, what was it like being in the audience seat? Or you had him as a client, so you were interacting with him, but I'm just wondering, did that have any kind of impact on you?
His impatience was everywhere in the industry. And actually, when you spoke with him, he had a reputation for being very direct. And indeed, he was very direct, but he's also very charming and very encouraging. So it wasn't tough conversations, but it was just tough standards that he was holding everybody to. And this is one of the sort of key lessons that I took away from my interactions with him, was that he was making sure that we were benchmarking ourselves against not the best in the industry, but the best of the best in the world and in any industry, exactly. And just to try and put that progress into context, and this is no disrespect or no affiliation to the companies I'm going to mention, but those life sciences companies that grew the fastest at about the same time were Medtronic and whereas he took the business from $1 billion to $26 billion in 13 years, it took Medtronic 23 years and it took Amgen 30 years to make that same growth, take that same trajectory. And it's not a direct comparison, But it's a bit of an illustration about how quickly he had been used to moving and how quickly he was encouraging us with all of his charm and involvement to move as quickly as possible.
Yeah, but I think my question is more on you. Like, I'll use myself as an example, right? If we all have, most humans at least have material aspirations, success aspirations, and so on. And seeing somebody who's met that, or who has that, and is struggling with an ailment and doing everything that they can to seemingly get over that. Was that something that was hard? Did it put anything into perspective for you as somebody that was dealing with him?
I guess something weren't too unused to, because we'd worked very closely with surgical teams, particularly on the deep brain stimulation side. So we were regularly getting that level of input. And whenever working with a leading neurosurgeon, a guy called Professor Steve Gill, who's still active in this particular area, whenever we weren't running quite quickly enough, he'd make sure that there was a reason for us to see a patient video or meet with a patient or something. So that we had a constant stream of the real
faith. Motivation.
Indeed.
Yeah. Slow dope, slow drip, micro dose on motivation. And that was your first intro into combination products?
Indeed. So I did that. I had this context of where we should be aiming for. And then I worked and took the same journey with various different companies since then. So I've taken companies in combination products, but in the wound care space along similar journeys. And then I found myself back in the combination product world, particularly when I joined the community-based organization BioForum before, trying to help combination product companies tackle some of the challenges together and encourage them to work together to tackle some of the challenges of working in such a highly regulated world.
What issues did you find?
In the BioForum world, they were identifying issues really surrounding about the interpretation and implementation of regulation. So issues relating to absence of human factors guidance, issues relating to the MDR and its implementation, and trying to work together to learn from each other and benchmark and find approaches that would allow everybody to move more quickly in that particular field, which is a laudable and incredibly important activity. One I've done, which is different to that, is try and work out how companies can work together within themselves. And also, if you look at the complexity of working in highly regulated environments, how much slower it is to be able to develop a product in that environment, try and understand why there is that the difference in pace. And I go back to the Intel example, where they were looking at launching new products every 2 years. And at the time, and still today, these timescales are still pretty stubborn, but at the average time for a medical device is between 4 and 7 years, depending on the risk categorization. And for a pharmaceutical, it's over 10 years. And if you look at you've obviously got things like clinical trials, things like additional documentation, you've got approval processes. All of these things take time and they're very difficult to compress. But if you look at the difference between 2 years and 4 to 7 years,
10.
Or 10 years, the maths doesn't add up. There's other things that are going on there that are meaning that there is quite that progression. What I've done for the last years is try to understand what are those things and then find solutions for them. And I've categorized them as two particular areas. One is multifunctional collaboration. Working in this highly regulated environment that we work in, you start to bring in different requirements, and therefore you bring in different people, different functions, regulatory teams, quality teams to be able to manage all of these things. And then you start to expand not only the number of people that are involved in projects, different perspectives and approaches and sometimes objectives that people are working to in there. And then the second group of factors are all classified as: the longer a project runs, the more chance there is that it's going to be delayed. And this is where you get factors such as average employee tenure being significantly shorter in many cases than the project lifespan, which means that you're getting changes or personnel at uncontrolled times during these projects, which can definitely have impact. And we've tried to measure this, and it's somewhere between 10 and 30% extension in timescales as a consequence of this sort of turnover, which is quite significant. You also lose the opportunity when you're running long projects for teams to develop muscle memory of how to get projects through very quickly. Or if you're running a project that's always 2 or 3 years, albeit your team will change over that, over several iterations, the team will learn as in general to go through those processes very quickly. If you're running a project that's running 10 years, it's much more difficult for that team to be learning how to do things much more quickly because they're doing things less frequently. They're doing the same things. If that makes
sense. Yeah, and that totally does. I think that's one of the more unfortunate things maybe in, I don't even know if unfortunate is the right word. One of the more difficult things in our industry is I know people who have something like 5 or 10 years of experience and have never launched a product. Indeed. And they just go from role to role or company to company. And because the cycles are so long, they've never experienced a project launch. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, indeed, the average tenure, if you look across the US, across all industries, is just over 4 years. If you look, this is with any one company, if you look at the average tenure in the different disciplines in medtech, in biopharma, in regulatory affairs, it's about 4.3 years, 4.5 years. In marketing, which is actually one of the more unusual, I didn't necessarily expect marketing to have such an impact project lifespan, but it seems to, if you're going to change in marketing lead in lots of places, particularly in medtech, that's about 4.1 years. And so those involved in drug discovery, drug development, R&D in medtech tend to hang around a bit longer, so a little bit over 6 years. And the average time in role is about half of each of those times. So typically it seems that we'll change role once and then leave on average, which if you compare, so if you look at an RA person leaving every 4 years and you've got projects that are averaging around 10 and a half years, it's quite possible you're going to have 2 or 3 RA people working on that, on an individual project. And therefore, it's quite possible that somebody can be in the industry for many years without actually seeing project the way through, which is a significant challenge.
I don't know if it was a quote or what that you said, the longer a project goes, the longer it takes or something like that. What was it that you said?
It's become a quote. The longer a project is, the greater risk that it will be delayed.
And so it's funny. I wrote a quote. I have a wall of quotes here. And the one that I wrote earlier today was, the future shall occur tomorrow, but won't feel like it until the day after. So it just reminded me of the longer it takes, the longer a project is, the longer it takes, or whatever it was. And you mentioned that when you were at Metaforum and engaging with all these stakeholders, that you saw that there were regulatory challenges, and then there were just like onesie, twosie collaboration challenges. You put them into two categories. Again, they were.
Oh, so the two categories that I've noticed, so the
were regulatory and the collaboration.
Oh yeah. Okay. So the challenges that Mediforum are dealing with are those technical challenges around specific issues such as Article 117.
Regulations. Yeah. Sure.
But the coalition recognition are these two buckets. One is multifunctional collaboration, getting all of the teams, all of the team members working together, trying to work out how within the restrictions that you may have within your organization and your design control processes and your quality management system in general, how you can best optimize team formation and alignment of performance and get them working as well together to make sure that the project can move as quickly as possible. The other one is looking at issues such as, how do you compensate for the fact that you might have people running the way through projects very regularly? So how do you bring lessons in from outside of your particular project? How do you make sure the best practices are always at people's fingertips? How do you structure teams and organizations knowing that you're going to be able to have, you're going to have turnover of team members over the lifetime of a project? And how do you make sure that the disruption of any changes in leadership in particular is minimized or is as small as possible? So these are the things we're doing within Coalition.
And so let's dive deeper into the second one, because at face value, I don't think you're going to get any disagreements conceptually, but it sounds a little squishy, nebulous-y. So can you give me an example of how, you know, a project that for sure, basically any project that's going to take 10 years, you're likely going to have someone leave. You're likely going to have something occur that, to the point that you were making earlier, the more activities you have to do, it's just like the easiest part to manage is the one that doesn't exist. So if you have two parts, then more things can go wrong, period. The same thing with tasks. If you have a 10-year project that has a lot of things that need to get done, then each one of those things could go wrong and has plus or minus whatever delay tolerance. But could you walk me through a meaningful example of dealing with that proactively? Because I think the general framework is just that, yeah, sucks, but price of doing business.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that's probably the attitude that we're fighting against, or at least starting to try and unpick. There are lots of different things that you can do. It will be very different for different organizations. But if you look at maybe turnover in RA being a key one, so there is undoubtedly disruption when you get different people coming in and looking at the same problem from a different angle. You could have the same person looking at the same problem from a different angle 2 days in a row and coming with a slightly different conclusion. So by the time you change somebody, then it certainly makes it more difficult. But it's all really about making sure that there's alignment through either the regulatory structure or through the team structure, so that everybody's really signed up to and aware and understanding of the direction that's been prescribed, and making sure that you're starting the projects knowing that actually the person that is signing off on documents to start off with and providing that input isn't necessarily going to be the person that we do when you come to the end. We've also built a mentoring structure that looks initially with people from outside of the organization to try and bring other people in other regulatory functions or within the regulatory function to act as a coach and buddy to support the regulatory team so that they provide consistency. So even if you get a change in one of the two people that are either by being coach or coachee, you've got some consistency. You've got somebody who's in that role and been in that role, unless by some misfortune they both leave at the same time. So there's different ways of being able to skin that particular or deal with that particular issue. One of the things that we tend to do, and this also goes into trying to reduce team sizes, is look at the different ways of organizing teams. So rather than having a core team that has a regulatory representative, human factors representative, so on and so forth, look at having and trying to borrow from Google and Amazon's approach of having 1 to 2 pizza size teams. So this is the theory that you can keep your team to the size that you can feed them over dinner with 1 or 2 pizzas. And then as to embed and stack roles within individual roles. So your head of your R&D representative, and you choose the right person in the right role with the right personality type, with the right relationship with regulatory, they become more responsible for the regulatory stewardship of the project. And the relationship with the regulatory team turns more into a coaching relationship and a guidance relationship, or a subcontract relationship to provide documentation as necessary. You're shifting the responsibility over a little bit more to give that consistency throughout. Does that make sense?
It does. So I've heard of the two pizzas thing before, and what you made me think about is you're focused on combination products where the teams are not just multidisciplined. Sometimes you have parallel drug person and device person for the same roles. Is that not harder to follow the pizza model?
It's probably the greatest challenge in collaboration that I've come across has been in combination products, right? Because you're quite right. You've got your pharmacy team and your device team. You've also got your device team ultimately reporting into somewhere in your structure, people who have got much more of an understanding of pharmacy than they have devices. So there's some knowledge and some communication issues there. You've then got these two separate teams. You've usually also got a device team for the manufacturer of the device that you're working alongside with a different quality management system, certainly a different team of people. And as these devices are getting more and more sophisticated, as the huge number of opportunities that will open up by this happening with bringing digital devices, diagnostic capability, all of these sorts of things for metering, then quite a number of these device companies are having to subtract those elements and software elements out of other parties. So yes, your supply chain and your team is ultimately very complicated. And therefore, being able to push everything back and force it back to a pizza-sized team as Amazon and Google may not be directly achievable, but learning from their approach and getting things as close as possible to that situation is something that we've been able to do. And changing the relationships and making sure that there are people responsible for the relationships for each stage in that or each part of that supply chain is also a big part of that.
Now, on that first category that we were talking about earlier, the multidisciplinary collaboration bit, and we were just touching on it a little bit with that last part of the discussion. What tools have you seen / what frameworks have you implemented that have really been meaningful in helping that collaboration? Because I think broadly speaking, I think combination products as an industry has matured in that there's a little bit more resources, there's a little bit more governance, a little bit more, but you still have situations where parallel expertise are just the name of the game. And there are no triple threat stakeholders that can just do it all, because the experiences for handling the device portion of a combination product and drug portion, in some cases, the only way to get that experience historically has been to work in one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're not trying to do is to make everybody an expert in everything. What we are doing is identifying where cross-training is important to make sure that there's greater appreciation of some of the challenges on both sides. But in terms of getting better teams formed, diversity is really important, right? And diversity in a project team is one of the things that small teams tend to miss out on. So we certainly don't want to discourage diversity, but it's understanding different personality types and different approaches. And we've built a Belbin type modeling approach, which looks at what different personality types that you've got in your team and allows a level of appreciation for everybody on the team about the sort of personality types, the way that people like to behave, the way that people like to receive information, to just make greater awareness of how communication can be improved and how different team members can work together. And sometimes it's also helpful knowing that sometimes you have people who are very detail oriented, some people who are less detailed but more broad thinking, that you need to start into those conversations, bringing people who will bridge the gap and be able to help translate and make sure that there is good collaboration between those two slightly more polar opposite personality types.
What do you hope to do with Coalition? What's the vision impact?
The overall aim, I guess, is going back to Andy's requirements, plus looking at also the expense that the industry takes on at the moment. So there's about $300 billion that was spent in 2023 on R&D projects in the life sciences industry. And many great things have been released. I don't think anybody's saying that we're done yet and that all projects have now been finished. And there are still, there's still the Andy Groves of this world that who are crying out for therapies that are not available to them. So what our aim is to try and speed progress up right the way across our regulated industries, but focusing very much on the life science industry to be able to get therapies into patients more quickly, to be able to get companies to get products out and for them to be generating that revenue more quickly as well.
Where can people find you, Matt?
So we have a website, which is coalition.ltd. I'm on LinkedIn. Coalition is present on LinkedIn also. And if you want to email me, it's matt.stratton@coalition.limited.
Excellent. Thanks for coming on, Matt. This was fun.
It was indeed. Thank you very much.